Making big family decisions as kids prepare for back to school, Emily Oster has a framework for those tough conversations. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Thursday, August 12th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome Brown University economist and author Emily Oster. We'll talk about help for families as they unpack complicated data about parenting, make decisions easier, more efficient, and based on common values. We look at President Biden's call for insurers to cover HIV prevention treatment, who benefits in the state, and what should you ask your doctor. We talk hibiscus and garden phlox with Eric Helland. Plus, Lynn Hart joins us to talk bullfighting, goldfish swallowing, and race relations. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Johnson. Firefighters are optimistic about getting a wildfire near Sturgis under control. The city is hosting its annual motorcycle rally that's expected to draw several hundred thousand people. The fire was reported Wednesday afternoon about 5 miles southwest of Sturgis in the Black Hills National Forest. The blaze is not expected to threaten the city. The fire size is an estimated 80 acres. Scott Jacobson is a spokesman for the National Forest.
Sounds like it's not putting up a column really much. It's getting smokes about 30 feet over the canopy of the trees. It's kind of flattening out, so fire behavior is not real aggressive right now.
Two helicopters dropped water on the fire. An airplane tanker put down fire retardant. Firefighters were using bulldozers to scrape a containment line around the fire. Numerous local, state, and federal agencies were involved. The cause of the fire is under investigation. Some structures were threatened, but Jacobson says there were no injuries or damage reported. One man is on a mission to inspire young people to pursue careers in science and technology. The historic preservation officer for the Flandreau Santee Sioux tribe says he's working for the future. SDPB's Jenna Scott has the story.
Gary Kills 100 does a lot of his work with drones and ground-penetrating radar. The technology uses electric pulses to let people detect what's beneath the surface. Kills 100 has used the radar with First Presbyterian Church in Flandreau to look for unmarked graves at the cemetery. The church can then put up a monument to mark the grave instead of leaving it lost underground. Accurate locations also prevent the church from accidentally digging up a grave in the future. Kills 100 is working with young tribal members to teach some of this technology.
Because of the social pathologies that we have on the reservation, I think that the one way we have to address this is through as many different ways as we can. And science and technology is going to be one of them.
Kills 100 demonstrates his equipment to kids at Marty Indian School. The pandemic put the brakes on these school demonstrations, but he plans to resume his school trips as a way to share his knowledge with students.
Helping other tribes will be a top priority too, just so that they can be exposed to this technology that we have here.
Kills 100 thinks this can open up potential careers to many Native Americans. For example, once they become registered as a licensed drone pilot, they can work independently or for a company.
Trying to get companies and tribes and different entities to accept younger people to do these jobs that they do so effortlessly, that's what I'm hoping comes to not just reservations, but everybody.
Kills 100 says he is already seeing a spark amongst kids who are interested in science.
And I really do think that some of these young people are following their spirit because they're talking. They'll go to a class and then they'll talk about, well, yeah, but in a few years we could do this. They're already thinking about the future and how they can use this technology.
Gary Kills 100 is continuing work with the church and community. He hopes to expand his travel to include more schools. I'm SDPB's Jenna Scott in Flandreau.
In addition to our daily news coverage, SDPB's reporting team also does regular deep dive investigations of the news and events that affect our lives in South Dakota. Look for our special reporting topics online at sdpb.org/news. For SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson.
And I'm Lori Walsh. The Sturgis Motorcycle Rally is in full swing. Mike Carlson is the Rapid City Area Engineer with the South Dakota Department of Transportation. He's joining us now with the nuances of the annual traffic count. Welcome, Mike. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
I think we should talk first about why these numbers matter, because for many people it's a curiosity and they look forward to hearing, but these this data is useful. Tell us about that.
Well, it's very useful for us. It allows us to know the size of the rally, also where the travelers are coming from and to entering and leaving Sturgis. And so that allows us to make adjustments year to year, event to event, to make sure that we can get people in and out of Sturgis as easily as possible.
How is that data used then, as far as like how quickly is it implemented and put in place when we talk about things like infrastructure?
We use it on a yearly basis. You know, we look at the data that we get, plus we look at anecdotal data as well, and see if we've got backups or concerns or near misses or accidents. And then every year we have a rally plan we put together, and we take a look at that rally plan and make adjustments to that, just to make sure that we can make sure that the people that are coming in to Sturgis have all the information they need, make sure they come in safely.
So when you went into this field as an engineer, this is like the coolest place to work, right? Because it's the biggest problem to solve. I mean, nationwide, like, you know, why not be in Sturgis, right?
Well, and it really is. You know, we bring a lot of people into Sturgis during this week, and we don't really have the infrastructure in place to do that because it's only 1 week out of the year.
Yeah.
You know, normally you'd have a 4 or 5 lane, 6 lane expressway coming in and out to accommodate the traffic. We don't have that ability to do that, and nor would we spend the money to do that just for 1 week. So we try to do other things to make sure that we can get people in and out.
Okay, like what? Give me an example of how you solve that problem as an engineer. I know I'm off topic now, but I'm really curious.
Well, what we do, we put temporary signals up in several locations in places that we know people have troubles exiting and entering the highway. We put variable message boards up warning people of the potential for stop traffic or slow traffic. We have curves that are come up unexpectedly with in some locations, especially up in the hills.
Yeah.
So I put signs up there, verbal message signs up there saying, you know, curves ahead, please use caution, those type of things, just so that, you know, the worst thing what we have out there are accidents. And then when we have accidents, our next biggest concern is secondary accidents because people are slowing down or stopping, and then someone's going to run into them, and then we have secondary accidents. So we try to do what we can to minimize that as much as possible.
Interesting. All right. How are you collecting that data? Are there people involved, like with little clickers? Is it all automated now? How is it collected?
I think everybody's seen those rubber tubes we put across the highways, and that's what we use here. We have 29 locations in and around Sturgis that we use. Some of them are used just for vehicles entering Sturgis, and some are for exiting Sturgis. So all we're really measuring for us is just vehicles entering Sturgis. And it could be a motorcycle with one person. It could be a bus with 30 or 40 people. So all we're really doing is measuring vehicles entering Sturgis.
All right. Early indications of the traffic count. What are you seeing so far?
Right now, traffic is up significantly from last year, which we expected. Since we had COVID last year, we knew it was going to be down a little bit. It was the 80th last year. Normally, the rallies that end in 0 or 5 are larger than the ones that are in between. So we expected a bigger one until COVID hit. It was down, and so we knew 81 would probably be up higher just because those people who didn't show up last year would want to come back this year. So right now, we have the 4-day total, Friday through Tuesday, we're up about 16% from last year. The other thing we did was we also looked at our 75th rally, which was our second largest, and just to compare, because we figured people would want to know what that comparison was. And at this time, we're about down 24%. But that was such a large rally. I remember being out there on that rally. Traffic was at a standstill at 10 o'clock in the morning. This time, traffic is moving relatively easily.
Yeah, up 16% from last year, but when you compare it to the 75th rally, it's down 24%. Do I understand that correctly?
That's correct.
All right. What happens next in the days ahead? What's left?
What we do, you know, right now we're in Thursday. So Thursday is usually a time where a lot of people start leaving. They have to get back, depending on how long their trip is. to get back to all parts of the United States. So it might take them 2 or 3 days to get back. So there are people that are leaving. And our biggest concern really is those people that are leaving and those that are still riding on their bikes. So now we have the mixture of motorcycles plus campers trying to leave. And we may even have some people trying to come back in because some people come in at the tail end of the rally just because there's less people on the roads and so they can enjoy the hills with less traffic. So that's our concern right now is those people that are leaving, those that are coming in, and those that are still riding their bikes, make sure that mix of traffic, everything still flows as well as it can, and so we don't have any serious accidents.
Yeah. Mike, what do you do when the rally is over? Like, do you have a personal, like, ritual? Like, this is the time that I sit on the deck and put my feet up? What do you do post-rally?
If only. Yeah, we still have road construction. We've got to get completed for the year. So once we get this rally over, we go right back into highway construction, try to get everything ready, and hope we have a nice, warm, moisture-free fall so we can get all our work done. And that happens every year. We go from one thing to the next. We go from construction to the rally to construction back to winter maintenance. And it happens on a yearly basis, and that's why this job is so much fun.
Yeah. Mike Carlson is a Rapid City Area Engineer for the State Department of Transportation. We'll have another update from Sturgis on Monday as the rally comes to a close. Mike, this has been a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Up next, a change in federal policy might make HIV prevention treatment more accessible for South Dakotans. Should you or someone you know talk with your doctor? You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
President Biden says the U.S. is back on the world stage, but in more than 6 months on the job, only one overseas ambassador has been confirmed, the lowest number in recent history.
Well, I'm quite sure it's not intended to be a signal of disrespect or lack of commitment to engagement with other countries. It can come across that way.
Biden's ambassadors, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. First Dakota National Bank celebrates individuals and businesses with a passion to turn their dreams into South Dakota firsts. Learn more at firstdakota.com/first.
Tenor saxophonist Troy Roberts and guitarist Tim Jago were both born and raised in Australia, and they both came to the U.S. to study at Ross School of Music in Miami. Last summer, they happened to be both back in Australia in the same place at the same time during a COVID lockdown, so they decided to make a record together. I'm Carl Gerke, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear tracks from their new album, Best Buddies. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting this year's One Book South Dakota, The Children's Blizzard by Melanie Benjamin. Learn more about her virtual author tour and in-person Festival of Books appearance at sdhumanities.org.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. This year marks the 40th anniversary of the first cases of a disease that would later become known by the acronym AIDS, caused by the human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV. Since then, 32.7 million people worldwide have died as a result of AIDS-related illnesses. Well, in June, the Biden administration directed insurers to cover costs for the HIV prevention treatment PrEP. Dr. Susan Hoover specializes in infectious disease at Sanford Health and is joining us to talk about the treatment and who should seek it. Dr. Hoover, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, nice to speak with you.
So what is PrEP?
PrEP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis, and it is a way in which a person who's at risk of acquiring HIV can take a medication every day to prevent themselves from being infected, even if they are exposed.
All right. Is it a pill, an injection? It must be a pill if you're doing it every day.
It's a pill, yeah. There are two different pills available. They are similar to each other. They have some small differences that a physician can help a person figure out which one is best for them. But yes, it would be one pill once a day.
Why not a vaccine at this point? 40 years now we've been watching this virus and its effects. Why not have
right.
a vaccine?
Yeah, it's not through lack of trying. It's a difficult virus to establish a vaccine for. It's an RNA virus. It mutates very readily, and it establishes itself in many parts of the body. It's not just in the blood. It's in the lymph nodes. It's in the gut, possibly in other tissues. So a vaccine has to really stimulate the immune system to find the virus wherever it is and eradicate it. And there have been some vaccines that looked like they were having a bit of an effect, but so far no vaccine has been found. The scientific community keeps on pursuing it and trying to develop new approaches. So that would be ultimate goal. That would be wonderful. And we're not there yet.
Yeah. Any hopes, glimmers from the fight against COVID and mRNA vaccines that some of that technology or, you know, the race to get the vaccine like we did might have seeds of a solution for an HIV vaccine?
So the mRNA platform is very exciting, and it's being pursued definitely for several other viruses, influenza, other respiratory viruses like human metapneumovirus. I'm not aware of any trials as yet for HIV.
All right. So does this mandate change anything? Because the Biden administration says this prevention treatment should be free if you have insurance. Are you seeing any impact of a policy like that?
So hopefully this will be a change. It was just put out in June, as you said, and they have some months to get in compliance, but I'm hoping that insurers will start to get in compliance with this. For some people, even if they had insurance, there were still copays, not only for the medication, but for the associated office visits and lab tests. So I think that this could be a game changer for many people. As you know, being insured doesn't guarantee that you can still afford your medical costs.
Right.
So yes, I think this will help.
And there are still many, many people in South Dakota who are uninsured, and this does really nothing to change their HIV prevention treatment at all? Or is there something I'm missing?
Yeah. Yeah, there are a couple different options for people with no insurance. Certainly, they should look into the availability, get help if they need it to go on the exchanges and see if there might be an insurance plan they would qualify for. But beyond that, the manufacturer has assistance programs for people who qualify in terms of income. And then there's a U.S. government program. Its name is Ready, Set, Prep, where they can help connect people with actually government sources of payment for PrEP. So there are some options available even if you are uninsured.
All right. And note to listeners, we're going to get medical now. Dr. Hoover, you said at-risk people. Tell us a little bit about HIV, how it is spread, and who is at risk.
Sure. So HIV is still spread primarily through sex and through injection drug use, specifically sharing needles and other equipment. So people who are at risk are, number one, people who have a partner with HIV. That is probably the number one population. And then certainly people who do not consistently use condoms as a barrier to HIV transmission during sex. And then, of course, if a person is injecting drugs and they're sharing any of their equipment, that would also be a person who's at high risk for HIV.
What kind of questions should you ask your doctor if you're trying to figure out if PrEP treatment is right for you?
So I would ask about the things that you just mentioned. Who is at risk? Am I at risk? If you are comfortable disclosing perhaps who your partner is, if you know whether they're infected, whether you've been diagnosed with another sexually transmitted infection in the past 6 months, to try to have your doctor help you get a feel for whether you're a person who would benefit. You, of course, would also ask, what are my options for paying for it? So you certainly don't want to get a prescription and not be able to pay. And then ask what your obligation would be. So it would be to get tested for HIV generally every 3 months, to have your kidney function monitored every 6 months, and to be tested for other sexually transmitted infections when it's appropriate. So what I would ask my doctor, what is it that makes me at risk? And if I were to start PrEP, what would I need to do?
We're going to talk with a representative from the State Department of Health tomorrow about surveillance and prevalence of HIV. Is there anything that you've noticed? I'm also looking at some other sexually transmitted diseases that are on the rise in the state. Anything you want to leave us with about how big of a problem this might be or how big of a risk we are at geographically?
So we know that we have a low population here in South Dakota, but our rates of sexually transmitted infections, as you mentioned, are actually fairly high. I don't want people to think that they are somehow safe because they live in a relatively low populated state. Other infections can lead to an easier acquisition of HIV, so treating those other sexually transmitted infections is really important to help reduce somebody's risk for acquiring HIV. And there are people who have HIV and are not aware, so that is the biggest risk both to themselves and to their partners. I would encourage people to seek out testing. Every adult should be tested for HIV at least once.
Dr. Susan Hoover is an infectious disease specialist at Sanford Health. We'll talk more about HIV in South Dakota tomorrow with a representative from the South Dakota State Department of Health. Dr. Hoover, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Ahead on In the Moment, data scientist Emily Oster was one of the leading national voices at the height of the pandemic as she sorted through what we know and what we don't know about remote learning and in-person learning in the time of COVID. Now she has a new book that helps families create a framework for decision-making. We'll hear from her next on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
You can always count on some friends to give you that extra push.
They gave me a lot of advice about retail sauces, and they're like, hey, you should bottle this. And I was like, you know what? That's a pretty good idea.
I'm Rima Jerez, selling sauce, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Reptile Gardens, beautiful botanical gardens and an indoor jungle full of tropical flowers and plants in the Guinness Book of World Records for the world's largest reptile zoo. For unforgettable memories today, reptilegardens.com.
Join your friends and neighbors by keeping SDPB strong. Become a $10 a month sustaining member and gain access to SDPB Passport. It's an on-demand library of hundreds of PBS and South Dakota Public Broadcasting shows, your favorites on your time. Details at sdpb.org/passport.
Program funding with your support and by McCrory Gardens in Brookings, planting over 40,000 flowers every spring. More information at McCroryGardens.com. McCrory Gardens, ready to bloom.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Making family decisions can be challenging and, let's be honest, stressful, even in the best of times. Well, what if you have to decide whether your kids can see their grandparents during a pandemic? Are they going into a classroom this fall with masks or without masks? When should you give your child a cell phone? What kind of cell phone? Enter Emily Oster. She's here to help you find the data you need for decision-making, and yet she understands the information you seek might be imperfect or unavailable. Her latest book is called The Family Firm, and it's a book that urges families to create a framework for decision-making. I spoke with Emily Oster earlier this week.
Yeah, so I think that the premise is really that in this kind of older kid parenting space, that we need structured decision-making and we need to be more deliberate, that the choices that we're making, the decisions that come up, they're unexpected. They aren't all the same. Data is not always the only piece. Yes, we need some data. We also need some logistics. We need to think about our priorities, and that putting all of those things together is really challenging, and is challenging if you haven't sort of thought about how to make those decisions right. And so I sort of talk about the idea that this is a question that firms grapple with. You know, how do we make good decisions? How do we be deliberate about our decisions? And the pitch in the book is that you should take that sort of same deliberateness into the family space, and that we shouldn't have kind of, we're thinking really carefully and being deliberate at work, and then at home just sort of doing whatever, because doing whatever is not going to lead us to the life that we want to have.
Right. And to be clear, this is not a, you know, great Santini structured, I mean, you're not running the firm as if it was. It really relieves, you know, having an ease of process relieves, it makes it easier to delegate. It makes it easier to make decisions. Tell me a little bit about how it can kind of free up the family difficult parts to make them more efficient so that you can have fun, you know, that so you can enjoy your life with your family.
Yeah, I think so. When you say like treat your family like a firm, I think people think of it like I need more spreadsheets to like put in more soccer practices, you know, and in some ways, like this is the opposite. It sort of says like basically we are spending too much time on these decisions. We're spending too much time kind of thinking about every little thing. And then if we thought about them once, and then we could have a sort of set of priorities or a set of rules, almost in some cases, we could move forward more quickly. And I think the other piece of it is that that when you sort of think deliberately about like, what do I want to be doing every day, some of what you will decide is you don't want to do things, right? And so I think that like there's sometimes people are like, well, this kind of approach wouldn't be for me because I like every weekend to be free and open and be able to do whatever I want. If you have school age kids and you want your weekends to be free and open to do whatever you want, you actually have to plan that. Because if you don't plan that, then they have a birthday party they go to, or you know, you've agreed to do some sports thing or some extracurricular without really thinking about it. And then you're kind of like free spontaneity is over. So I think there's a sort of pitch here around, you know, we can save time by spending some time upfront. And, you know, we can deliver spontaneity almost by planning it, which sounds insane. And when it comes out of my mouth, I'm like, I can't believe I'm going to go on the radio and be like, plan your spontaneity. But like you do, you have to plan your spontaneity or your kid's going to Dave and Buster's for like a birthday. You guys probably don't have Dave and Buster's. That's what we have. It's like an indoor. It's terrible. Anyway, don't go to Dave and Buster's. Well, if you like Dave and Buster's, that's for you. But anyway, if you don't want to be at Dave and Buster's, you need to plan not to be there. That's my point.
I used to have a plan that if it's Chuck E. Cheese around here. And so if there was a birthday party at Chuck E. Cheese and I went, however long that birthday party was, I would get double that time to be by myself afterwards. So if it was a 2-hour party, then we were going to block 4 hours for mommy time when we were done. So I could just go read a book. And that was the rule.
No,
and we stuck to it. So there was a cost. A 2-hour Chuck E. Cheese party is really 6 hours on the calendar for me, because that's just how I felt about the experience and the stimulus of being there. You talk about the big picture in tortoise, because you know, you give scenarios in this book, and like somebody might want a spreadsheet for more soccer practice because soccer is part of their family's big picture. Somebody else might not want that. So talk a little bit about this big picture family planning and like the mission statement. What do we want out of our family? What are our shared values?
Yeah. So I think there's kind of two pieces of this, and in both pieces, I really am kind of pushing people a little bit to like write it down. And to be actually sort of talk, like plan a time to talk with your partner about some of these things. And one piece is really abstract. Like what is the kind of big, is your family mission statement? Like we value family togetherness and our church. Is that like, or is our mission statement, you know, we value academic achievement. Something big picture, and then some sort of big priorities like, you know, family time, school, like whatever those are. So there's a sort of abstract piece of this. What are the big values? And then there's a more practical piece. And I think for me, this is kind of the thing that helps me the most is to actually write down, like, what do you want every day to look like, right? Because your life is made of Tuesdays and Saturdays and Mondays. And if every Tuesday is unpleasant, well, that's like seven, that's, you know, every Tuesday is Chuck E. Cheese. Like, it's, you know, that's every Tuesday. And so really to sort of be explicit about what do you hope that those days will look like, and then think about how you can, you know, how you can get there, how you can get closer to that. And then also you want to be on the same page with whoever you're parenting with, about what priorities are important, even if getting on that same page entails a little bit of conflict or a little bit of deciding, you know, that like, this is something that's important to me and we need to, and I want to make it so we understand it's something that we prioritize, even if it's, you know, not as important to you, and there's some other thing that's important to you that we're prioritizing. So I think that there's a little bit of kind of aligning our values aspect here that is central to having this approach work.
Great for single parents as well, I found.
Yeah, I mean, I think partly because your day is your, and in some ways, like the sort of decision making under constraints, there may be more constraints there, and that may, you know, and that it may be, it's not just, you know, working with your partner, it's working with yourself, you're partnering yourself.
Yeah, because some of these kids, these school age kids, they can talk back. You know, the swaddling, you know, you talk about swaddling in the introduction, just, you know, swaddling, you can do the research, you can say for most babies, swaddling is a really good thing. All the studies say it, I'm going to swaddle. And it turns out to be a good thing. You can look at the research on breastfeeding versus bottle feeding and kind of make decisions about what works for your family. Babies aren't going to tell you that you're ruining their life if you didn't breastfeed them or if you did. Whereas a third grader who wants to be in the play might say, this is a really big decision. So even if you're a single parent, having your ideas down of like, well, no, we eat dinner as a family and there's a reason we're doing that. Therefore the play isn't going to fit in or making those adjustments. I found that interesting.
Yeah. And I think that there's a sort of value to writing those down or to having them kind of in the outside, because particularly when you're negotiating with kids, there's something to saying that's the rule that sort of externalizes, right? I mean, it's like you find it when you're teaching also, right? Sometimes students will be like, well, I need an extension. You say, I'm so sorry. In the syllabus, it says no extensions. And so I wish I could help you, but it says in the syllabus, you know, and of course I wrote the syllabus. Like I'm the owner of the syllabus, the same with parenting, right? Like you're the person who decided on the family dinner, but to be like, you know, actually, I'm really sorry. Like we're not going to be able to do that because one of our family rules is to do this. I think sort of helps. It almost makes that an easier negotiation. Yeah, but I think there's a piece here. It's sort of interesting you say with kids, as kids get older, I think there's also a complicated piece about engaging them and thinking about where in these processes you sort of want to take their input and where you want to say, you know what, ultimately, like the family, this is the family decision and you don't have a say on that. But of course, as they get older, they should probably get more of a say.
So. Yeah. And again, that depends on your family. So I have an only child. Very smart, very engaged, very, you know, communicative. She always had a huge part of making family decisions. If I had four kids, I suspect it would have been less so because I would have been outnumbered.
Yeah. Because you can't like, what if they disagree? How are you going to?
Yeah. Right. So I want to talk about this framework for making decisions, the four F's, because this is super, super helpful. I think let's go through those real quickly, if you don't mind.
Yeah. So this is a framework really for sort of big decisions. So if you have a big decision to make, how to approach it. The first step is to frame the question, is to articulate not just, you know, should I do this or not, but to really say, what are the choices? Is it A or B? And so once you do that, I think that gives you a place to go to look for information. Second step is fact finding. Some of that is getting data. You're thinking about schools, maybe you get some data on the schools, maybe you get some information on what makes a good school. But also a part of that is logistics, is like family structures, thinking about if these things align with your values, sort of really trying to just get all the information that you need together in one place to try to make a decision. The third step is final decision. I think recognizing that in order to do, to make good decisions, we need to plan to just make the decision at a time rather than to let it percolate and percolate and percolate kind of forever. So that's the third step. So kind of plan a meeting or plan at least a time where you sit down, you make the choice, and then try to move on, except for the fourth F, which is follow up, which is to say that for almost all our decisions, we have a temptation to say, okay, once I've made it, like I made it, that's it. I'm never going to think about it again. But actually you almost always could change your mind. And rather than following up and rethinking it every day, you want to have a concrete time to say, okay, in 3 months, in 6 months, in a year, whatever is a good cadence, we're going to think about this again and decide whether we made the right choice or whether we want to make a different choice going forward. So frame the question, fact find, final decision, follow up.
And not every decision can have equal urgency. No. Although during the pandemic, it sure as heck felt like it.
No, it didn't. I think people ended up, you know, I wrote a lot about sort of versions of this kind of framework for making some of these pandemic decisions. And I think there were many more things that felt like that. I think a sort of good news for people who are like, that decision process sounds exhausting, is that there are actually very few decisions for which I think right. you really need this kind of thing. It's, you know, it's school, it's kind of big picture extracurriculars, it's things like that. You know, can you have a tuna sandwich? You can just kind of decide about that. You don't need to.
Should my kid get a phone? When should they get a phone? What kind? So that goes back to framing the question. It's not just should I have a phone or not. It's are we even talking about the same kind of phone? So let's start with what exactly is, and then what is the alternative? So walk us through an example. Let's say, you know, getting a phone for, you know, what age is appropriate to give my child a phone? What that's going to be different for many families. Walk us through how those four F's would sort of play out in a scenario.
Yeah, so I think the sort of first F there is to really ask what kind of phone are we talking about? What are, you know, why would we do this, right? So I think that the, you know, is it a flip phone? Is it an Android phone? Are we thinking about this for social media? Are we thinking about it for just like calling me after soccer practice? So actually kind of get on the same page about what you're asking about. Then look into some of the data. And I think on this case, you know, the sort of most interesting, most important data in some ways is about, you know, how do we think about things like social media use and their impacts on kids, which is what many people worry about with phones. And the data there is kind of mixed. Like on the one hand, this can really be great for kids as an opportunity to connect with a, you know, with other peers or to, you know, to connect more socially, to connect with a broader set of peers. On the other hand, there are also links with depression or anxiety, particularly in girls. And so that's a kind of, there's a sort of mix there. And I think it depends a lot on the kid. So you get all that information, think a little bit about your kid, make a decision about whether to get the phone or not. And this is a place where I think the follow-up piece is in many ways the most important. You know, if you don't get your kid a phone, of course, you will be following up and revisiting this decision, presumably every 15 minutes until you say yes. But if you do get a phone, I think that we often think about that, like, I'll give my kid a phone, then we'll never talk about it again. But no, you should actually plan a follow-up for that, because so much of what we know about the positive or negative impacts of phones has to do with your individual kid. So there's a really, I think, a huge amount of value to thinking about initial sort of phone time as a trial, as kind of like, in 3 months, we will talk about how this is going and think about, is it, should we not have the phone? Should we have the phone with more restrictions? Is the phone actually going fine? That isn't a real opportunity. If you spring that on your kid, that's not gonna be so good. If you say upfront, okay, we've agreed to give you a phone, but I just wanna let you know in 3 months, we're gonna revisit this and we're gonna think about it. We're gonna think about it again. They might still be upset, but they don't have as much reason to be upset.
Yeah, that's a good example, and tying it one more time into the pandemic. What if there isn't data? You know, in South Dakota, you know, schools were largely open. There was a period of time when the buildings were closed and people were learning remotely. But a lot of parents in South Dakota had to make decisions about what they had options. And there wasn't a lot of information at the time. And this was something that you were really writing about a lot during the pandemic. What kind of data are parents looking for to make some of these decisions that are really brand new, unprecedented? And how do they find them? Like, what can school districts do to provide the data that parents need if they are allowed to make that decision? You know, how do they make it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that really what parents are looking for, and I was just writing about this today, is information on, you know, how risky is this for my kids, and how important are the kinds of mitigations that we maybe are or are not putting in, you know, putting in place. And I think that that this is a circumstance in which we haven't done a great job broadly in sort of providing people with detailed answers to that questions. You know, we know that kids are fairly low risk. That's very encouraging. So that's good. On the other hand, they can get COVID. It's not that likely to get it in school. No, something nobody has ever gotten in school. So I think there's really sort of, if anything, kind of the biggest push here is probably for transparency and for sort of, and I think that's beyond just wanting to have the data. I think parents want to know that they will hear if there's something going on, that there's going to be transparency around what's happening at schools. And that's something we didn't do a great job with last year.
Emily Oster is an economist and author. Her latest book is called The Family Firm. It's available now, and it is chock full of toolboxes that include how to create Google Forms and share Google Calendars with your family. You can find a link to her work on our website with today's show notes at sdpb.org/news. Let's take a moment now to visit Madison, South Dakota. Madison is the home of Dakota State University, where the Beacom School of Computer and Cyber Sciences has become nationally recognized in cybersecurity education and research. Well, this time of year, Lake Madison is a popular destination for camping, fishing, boating, and water skiing. Madison, like much of South Dakota, is feeling the impact of the drought, though. The most recent South Dakota Drought Monitor shows Madison in the extreme drought category. The 10-day forecast is showing no chances of rain. Highs in Madison will top out in the upper 70s through Friday. Highs Saturday through next Wednesday should be all in the mid-80s. One thing to get excited about this weekend is the opening of a new season at the Brick House Community Arts Center. The Brick House was established in 2009 to better serve the arts and cultural needs of the Madison area. It's sustained and funded through supporters and the ongoing support of the City of Madison. Tomorrow night, the Brick House season opens with a concert by the All Madison lineup of singer-songwriter Mike Lee, joined by Cody and Johnny Frito. All shows at the Brick House, free, open to the public. Vaccinated guests are welcome to attend programs in person at the Brick House this season. A live stream is also available for those wishing to watch from afar. Mike Lee stayed busy throughout the pandemic by writing songs like Quarantine With Me and Don't Let Me Get Sick This Year. He describes his music as cosmic Americana. Lee has been living the last 6 years in New York City, where he's seen several of his friends and colleagues struggle due to venues being shuttered as a result of COVID-19. Music at the Brick House starts at 8 p.m. tomorrow night. That's in Madison. Coming up, more ways to enhance your garden and landscape. Eric Helland of Landscape Garden Centers in Sioux Falls joins us after the break. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Robin Young. The FDA banned electric shock treatments at a residential school for challenged kids. An appeals court overturned that ban, even though the FDA statement said the treatments can cause
worsening of underlying symptoms, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, pain, burns, and tissue damage.
Next time, here and now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by the Hot Springs Chamber of Commerce Fall River Hot Air Balloon Festival, August 27th through the 29th. 33 hot air balloons, night glow around town, free kids zone, and more in Hot Springs. More at fallriverballoonfest.com.
SDPB's Fiddles and Friends returns this August with three live concerts. Enjoy music from talented fiddlers including Kenny Putnam, Tom Schaefer, and Owen DeYoung. Join us in Watertown on August 26th, Sioux Falls on August 27th, or on August 28th in Rapid City. Help support SDPB and get your tickets today by going to sdpb.org/fiddles. Sponsored by Chris Bro Hospitality and First Bank and Trust.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota, encouraging the development of artistic talent and appreciation in all South Dakotans. Advancing the arts through education, service, and advocacy. More at artssouthdakota.org.
Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, it is not too late in the season to enjoy the bloom of colorful flowers in your garden. Today, we're going to talk hibiscus and garden phlox with Eric Helland as a part of our weekly South Dakota Home Garden segment. Eric is with me in the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. Hey, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm excellent, and I think it's no secret the hibiscus is my favorite because my tortoise eats the hibiscus flowers.
Right, right. So, and I don't know if we've even talked about this kind of hibiscus. This is a different hibiscus than what you're than I've always been talking about.
Yeah, this is new, but this is the one he really likes. I was confused before because this is the big dinner plate size flowers. This makes him happy for a long, long time.
Well, I'm sure.
Most people are not growing hibiscus to feed their tortoises.
No, there's... Yeah, very few.
They're also pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the hibiscus.
So hibiscus, this plant, let's go on that little little adventure. It plant is either going to be green, a deep, deep green, and the leaves are going to be kind of a serrated leaf, outside leaf, not real, real big. And it's very, very similar as far as kind of what it looks like when you actually compare a tropical hibiscus and a zone four hibiscus, let's call it. And also sometimes the foliage can be more of a purplish or a red foliage, and then you get these awesome blooms. And the blooms, of course, like they will produce dinner plate size blooms. So they are
tortoise seriously dinner size, yeah.
10 to 12 inch. Yeah.
Yeah.
The tortoise will eat it.
It'll take some time.
Yeah. So this dinner, so it's like the size of a clock.
It's beautiful.
You know, it's just huge, and they're just beautiful, and you really can see. When a flower is that big, you can actually get up closer to it and see the intricacies of the pistil and the stamen and all of the details of what a flower really is. And so it's kind of unique. It's a great learning experience for kids because it's such a big flower.
Yeah.
And we don't have a lot of big flowers around here.
How many colors do these come in?
I knew you were going to ask me that, and I didn't prepare myself for that, but there's quite a few. Pinks, reds,
We ask the hard questions here in the moment.
Yes, you do.
We'll put you on the spot.
The ones, there's, I don't know for sure, but I know there's like the ones that we were selling today, like whites, and then they have this pink and this purple center, and then they are also big ones that are actually the flower itself is just more of a pink.
Pink, type, yeah.
But I'm more of a white pink. I don't get into light pink, dark pink.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah. All right, and phlox, what's that?
Phlox. Okay, so phlox have been around a long, long time, and you can actually see these types of phlox, the tall phlox. Tall phlox, you'll see them along the ditch or along a woodland, kind of an area where it would be on the east side or even on the north side, northeast side, growing right outside, so it's getting quite a bit of morning sun, but then gets shaded in the afternoon, right? And these are going to, from a distance, you're going to see them as mostly green foliage with these white flowers. And these white flowers, this is kind of the opposite. It's not one big gigantic flower. It's multiple flowers, tiny flowers that make up this big flower. So that's a tall phlox. And the tall phlox are blooming right now, and they will come in lots of different colors, the pinks, the oranges, the whites. And they are probably 1 to 2 feet tall, and they'll just kind of keep on spreading and growing wider and wider because they'll just keep on, like a lot of other perennials, they'll just get wider at the base and continue to grow. They're very, very tough for this area. But then there's also a moss phlox or a creeping phlox or something that almost looks like a carpet, an evergreen type. So it's complete opposite in the same family. One gets tall, one stays short. And this one will have already bloomed in the spring, but it's a rye fern kind of I'm explaining how I think it is, but evergreen. But it's great to use those around rocks and boulders because it will just kind of act like a sweater or an afghan that'll just kind of keep those rocks warm.
You're a poet.
Yeah, wasn't that good? You like that one? Yeah.
And they have blossoms too, or is it?
Yeah,
like
they'll bloom, but they've already bloomed like in the spring. You might see some right now. Like I know we have one big patch of them at the front of our store, and that is just they're not. There's maybe a couple miscellaneous blooms on them, but nothing significant.
So the videos. This is just a very tactile conversation, and you're so good at describing things. But I wish listeners could see how you use your hands when you describe them.
Because
when you watch the video, you can just see
you're
sort of running your fingers through all these, and just such a that's gardening. That I mean, that's
you
who you
use
are.
Your
you
hands,
gotta
even
use
when
your
I
hand.
Talk. Yeah,
you're gonna go get dirty, and you're gonna stick your hands in the soil and feel it, and watch those blossoms, and tell your kids exactly how flow works based on that enormous flower, and then feed your tortoise.
Yep.
You know what happened at my house last night?
I could only
guess. Brought a chicken to my door.
Oh,
not making that
a
up.
Live chicken?
Somebody knocked on the door and said, "Is this your chicken?" So
did you ask a tortoise? Was it?
I panicked,
name?
And that's that is a question with a very long answer.
Okay.
The tortoise has multiple names
okay.
that change at different times throughout the day. But there was a loose chicken in our neighborhood. He had
band. It would have been funnier if it would have been a rabbit that showed up or a hare. And the hare of the tortoise. He's
going into
there.
I am regretful that I did not put the chicken in my backyard and say, yes, I would take that chicken.
Yeah.
But it did belong to somebody else. Yeah. So show up at my door with a flower, hibiscus, some phlox, a tortoise, a chicken.
Yeah.
It's just nice to...
You can't make that up.
You just can't make these things up. Welcome to South Dakota Home Garden. I'm going to give you some ways that you can participate in these just sort of delightful conversations and be part of the South Dakota Home Garden family. Tune in on Thursdays here through September. We're kind of we're getting toward the wrap-up time. So a few more times to hear Eric Helen answer some of your questions. If you have any, send them to inthemoment@sdpb.org. Follow us on South Dakota Gardeners on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Use the hashtag SDHomeGarden. And, of course, you can find all the digital series videos posted online. Those pop up on Thursdays, I think. They're posted every week. I think Thursday is the same day that you're here. You can find the hibiscus and phlox video now.
Yep.
Eric Helen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Always a delight to have you here.
Have a great week.
Keep it growing.
Yep.
Throughout his career in rodeo, it was Lynn Hart's job to protect the competitors. The job of a rodeo bullfighter is filled with danger and drama. It's a profession at which Watertown native Lynn Hart excelled. The arena was not the only venue of Hart's influence, though. He helped usher in Native American Day in South Dakota, and he played a part in making sure South Dakota would recognize Dr. Martin Luther King Day as well. Well, Lynn Hart is the first South Dakotan to be inducted into the National Multicultural Western Heritage Hall of Fame in Fort Worth, Texas, and he's joining us now on the phone. Hey, Lynn, welcome.
Hey, how you doing? Good to hear your voice.
It's good to hear your voice, and congratulations. This is a big deal.
Thank you very much. I'm still speechless and humbled by the recognition on a national level.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about being a bullfighter and how you kind of got into the arena. Where did that start for you?
Actually, I was in the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
When I was stationed in Yuma, Arizona. And then once I got out of service, I was rather good at it, so I went professional. And I my first rodeo in the PRC was at Sutton Rodeo in Oneida, South Dakota. I drew a bull called J.C. Spectacular's Velvet, Bucking Bull of the Year, and I rode him for 7-9. So after doing that, then people were like, who are you traveling with? You know, what's your name? Where are you from? You know, and of course, being a black cowboy in Dakota was like being a salt or a flake of pepper and a salt shaker. So yeah, there you go.
So you have carried your, your courage from the Marine Corps, from the arena, and your sense of humor into lots of areas in your life. Tell me a little bit about this idea of going to peer and being heard about something like Native American Day or Martin Luther King Jr. Day in the state. That's a big deal to do as well.
Yeah, that was also, I received the National Making of the Martin Luther King Holiday Award from King, January 13th, 1992. Basically, the idea that I wanted to appear, South Dakota needs, because I was the last, unfortunately, that failed to recognize the holiday. They were saying it costs too much to have this holiday. I was saying it's going to cost you too much not to have this holiday. Mm-hmm. And not only that, we have Mount Rushmore in our backyard. It's Thomas Jefferson states, all men created equal. Now, if you don't believe in that, then blow it up and move it to a state that does, basically.
All right, today, Lynn Hart, later on, I think it's already happened now at this time, but the U.S. Census data has been released. And one of the big things that we're watching in a change of census is people's ability to identify on that form their different parts of their heritage. This is something that when you find a box to check, it's been hard for you to check it. Tell us a little bit about self-identity and expressing the multiple cultural influences in your life. What kind of challenges have you had to had to overcome when people ask you, like, oh, you know, what's your ancestry?
Well, it's pretty simple. My mother's a full-blooded Yankton Sioux. My dad was black. And that's one thing people need to realize when they do their ancestry. America has it backwards. They always have. The only one that got it right is American. We ask their ancestors, German American, Asian American. No. If you want America to be first, then you got American, German, American, Asian. So America, start putting America first and start explaining who you are with the word American first. And so that's what I do, and that's what I'm about. Is my goal in life is to bring people together racially, spiritually, and let people understand what it's like to be a person of color in South Dakota. And my goal in life is right now is to take the awards, both national awards, to the schools. If South Dakota Education Association, whatever, invite me to come to their schools and talk to their kids, because a lot of kids in South Dakota never meet a black man, Indian. Why are they scared of, you know, critical race here? What's this about? All that is racism, fancy word. So I disagree with Governor Noem's attitude about not allowing the American Indian's culture to be taught in schools. Now, that's a very touchy subject for me, and because if you don't know about me, how much? I mean, I already know about you because I was raised white. I had to learn to be Indian. I had to learn to be black. So my mother calls me a chameleon because I'm able to go in all worlds, all different cultures, you know. And it's made a better person. It's made a more rounded person. And I think that's what our kids need to do today, is to learn about other cultures and to understand them. And bring people together, not apart. And that's what I want to do the rest of my life, is go to schools, talk to kids. And so I'm waiting for Governor Kristi Noem to come in and first of all, congratulate me. But I think he's busy out in Sturgis right now. But the point is, I don't understand why we can't talk about who we really are. Because Native American heritage and the culture and the history in South Dakota is out.
Lynn Hart, thank you so much. It was so nice to meet you. We really appreciate your time. Come back again.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Have a great day.
Lynn Hart is the first South Dakotan to be inducted into the National Multicultural Western Heritage Hall of Fame in Fort Worth, Texas. A couple of notes there. He said he was raised white because he was raised by white parents as a foster child. And also, I apologize there for that audio quality. I know he cut out. We worked this morning on that cell phone connection, and sometimes that's just part of living in South Dakota.